they have shown a fierceness that is very powerful and very commendable, and are standing up, not just for themselves, but for everybody around the world that is facing other kinds of corporate injustice.
I had the opportunity to meet Rashida B. and Champa Devi at their Chingara. Explain what that is and what they're doing there.
These two leaders of the Bhopal struggle, Rashida B. and Champa Devi, were recipients of the Goldman Foundation Prize, which awarded them $125,000. And rather than taking the money for themselves, they set up a trust called the Chingari Trust. The trust is engaged in a couple of different projects. One is providing an award each year to a woman who is involved in an important struggle in the country around corporate crime. The second big area is that they set up a school for children with severe birth defects, and they're providing the funds for those kids to get physical therapy and to get some kind of education and some kind of support for them and their families. So it's quite commendable.
When I was at Chingari, they showed me some slides of the various children that have been affected with terrible, many of them cleft palate problems. And after a while, I couldn't watch it. It was just so painful. It was so unbearable.
Yeah, the second generation is an incredibly powerful symbol of what Bhopal is today. You have these very visible birth defects where people's children's fingers are fused together. You have cleft palate. You also have a huge number of children who were born immediately after the disaster, especially boys, stunted growth, mental retardation. Some children compulsively eat dirt, which is, of course, contaminated in this area. And these children are within a setting of socioeconomic difficulty as it is. Their families hide them away and sometimes won't bring them for treatment at all, because if somebody knows there's a disabled or poisoned child in your family, you can't marry any of your children off, which means economic burden for the rest of your life in a very poor family. Also, the contaminated water issue. You have women and girls waiting in line for what little clean water they could get for the last 10 plus years, fighting over poison water sometimes, spending hours in line trying to get this clean water, not going to school, not having time to take care of basic family needs. So Dow's legacy in Bhopal, with these children carrying the poisons of this entire generation on their faces, unable to remove it, is really Bhopal today. And it's not something that we're going to let Dow Chemical forget about until they clean up in Bhopal.
I walked in the area between Sabhavana Bhavan and the plant, and there's a stream. I don't even know if you could call it a stream. Right behind, it's not flowing. It's not streaming. It's completely clogged up with waste and plastic bags. And then, curiously, you see new constructions next to wretched what are called jhuggis in India. These like cardboard huts. Why are people building there?
Well, Bhopal is an expanding city, and so people continue to build and to fill in areas that were garbage dumps and industrial wastelands. The contrast between the Sambhavna Clinic and the factory, which is a mere quarter mile away, is a really powerful counterpoint, because you have the factory with it really represents, it's a death factory. It represents the worst abuses of the chemical industry in the 20th century. And then you have this flourishing, beautiful clinic that represents the best of green building design. And there's a Ayurvedic clinic growing the herbs that are treating the patients there. And so you have this very powerful counterpoint between hope and life and death.
Has the UN taken up this issue at all?
There has been a visit by a UN rapporteur on food and water to Bhopal, but I'm not sure what the outcome has been of that. We'll certainly be reaching out to them in this 25th anniversary year since the disaster to see what else can be done. But the Indian government is currently slowly, we hope, moving towards a commission that will actually involve the survivors on the federal level in solving these problems. I think that the Bhopal movement is really exemplary in involving the survivors, the people most affected by the problem we're addressing, at the heart and the core of what we're doing. And it's shown that the Indian government, while it's not been able to serve its own people, if you can involve the people who are most affected, things will get corrected. And we've had a recent victory in Bhopal in that 12,000 people do have clean water now in these water-affected areas, and we're stopping the cycle of poisoning. And that's a direct result of a long series of protests and sit-ins in New Delhi, 500-mile marches by survivors advocating for their basic right to not be poisoned every day in the water they drink. So we have a really vital movement coming up here. And I just want to mention that two of the second generation survivors who are not visibly affected in terms of birth defects but are incredibly powerful advocates for their rights will be coming to the U.S. in April and May of this year, 2009. And you can look on bhopal.net, B-H-O-P-A-L. .net or studentsforbhopal.org, and check out when they might be coming to your town.
There is a UN-sponsored meeting in May called the International Conference for Chemical Management that is talking among 180 countries about the future of chemicals management on the planet. And certainly the Bhopal story will be one of the poster child stories at that event because it highlights a number of very important things that we've learned in the last 25 years about toxic chemicals, which is that it's not just the impact on the people who are initially exposed to toxic chemicals, but it's the hand-me-down poisons. It's the ones that impact the next generation. And if we've learned anything in the last 25 years, it's that toxic chemicals at very, very small doses can impact the developing fetus and the young child and lead to long-term health impacts for the next generation.
Dow itself has a dubious record, as it was the producer of Agent Orange, which was spread in great quantities over the Vietnamese countryside. And so now, 40 years after that American war in Vietnam, there are still Vietnamese children being born with defects and all kinds of health problems.
Dow has grown up with many different disasters in their closet. Agent Orange was one of them, but so was napalm. And so was another chemical pesticide called DBCP, which was found to make workers sterile. And so in Latin America, there's reports of over 15,000 banana workers who've been made sterile by this chemical. They've also a producer of another chemical that's been notorious in this country called bisphenol A, which has been found in baby bottles and other products. And so there's actually a very powerful kind of solidarity that people around the world who are organizing around toxic chemicals feel with people in Bhopal, because the same chemicals that are in the bodies of people in Bhopal are also in our bodies and our children's bodies. And so in an unwitting way, Dow has created a network of people united by their own poisons. And we see ourselves as linked to fighting for a toxic-free future so that children all over the world can be born without toxic chemicals in their bodies, and that mothers all over the world can breastfeed their infants without passing on their lifelong supply of chemical poisons onto them.
And tell me about Environmental Health Fund. What is it?
Environmental Health Fund is an organization that specializes in building networks and coalitions to support transformational change around chemicals and health. And we facilitate international campaigns and national campaigns and other efforts to build citizen power, to change the rules of the game around how people are being protected from toxic chemicals.
And how can people affect the Bhopal issue specifically and in general get involved on changing the rules of the game, as you say?
Sure. We have chapters of the Bhopal campaign, about 15 cities in the United States. We have chapters in Toronto, in London. There are about 10,000 people who support the Bhopal cause in the UK alone. So pretty much anywhere you are, if you want to go to bhopal.net or studentsforbhopal.org and let us know that you're interested in the Bhopal issue, we can connect you with people who are already working on the issue. There's certainly a lot of activity and help that's needed here in the United States to make sure that our largest chemical company, Dow Chemical, is held to account for the 23,000 deaths in Bhopal, which thus far no one has been held legally liable for all those deaths. And I think it's important for all of our health and safety that that legacy is changed. So come help.
And funding for the Environmental Health Fund, how could people contribute to that?
We will have a website up, environmentalhealthfund.org, within about a month. We don't have one right now. But you can call us at 617-524-6018 if you'd like to get in touch.
Whilst I sympathize with the sentiment of punishing those responsible, it seems to me much more important that we embrace the reunion and say, let us look forward to how can we create a world in which babies are not born containing toxic chemicals. How can we heal the damage which was done by the separation? Now, we've been looking mostly at chemistry, but to make the point about how the economic system, which would split us all into separate competing units with no feeling for one another, to make the point about how closely that is implicated in the ongoing chemical civil war, let's hear an interview about a woman whose film implicates the largest chemical companies in double-dipping on cancer, that is, cutting corners, saving money and therefore creating cancer, and earning money in the business of treating cancer.
Joining us today is Emmanuelle Schick Garcia. She is the movie maker to whom, you know, we owe the great debt of having created the Idiot Cycle, and that's what our interview is going to deal with today. Hi, Emmanuel, how's it going?
Great. Hi, Donald. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
Let's get started talking about dioxin and cancer. This is my understanding that dioxin and cancer are a serious part of this movie, The Idiot Cycle. Let's start with, how did you come to be interested in, knowledgeable, concerning, involved with this subject area of dioxin and cancer?
7 years ago, actually, when I was 23, 24, my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. And at the time, we didn't have any family history of cancer, and there was no reason that she could have developed cancer at age 49. She didn't drink, she didn't smoke, she ate well, she was an athlete. So we were a little puzzled, and the doctors usually can't tell you what caused your cancer, because 15% of cancers are hereditary, and the rest, you could have a chromosomal breakage, but you don't know if it's benzene that caused it. Could be a number of things, and no doctor can tell you. There's no imprint on that damage. Oh, you know, it was benzene, or it was dioxins, or it was so on and so forth. So I started doing research with my sister. My sister is now a doctor, and at the time we were really curious as to why she'd become sick. Then that led us to looking at treatments, because of course there are certain treatments that you can partake in, and why there were so few options. I started looking into, because I was doing documentaries at the time, I started making documentary films when I was 23, what these companies were doing, who they were, what were their other products were, and I started doing more research on cancer. And then I realized that the same companies who were very, I guess, incriminated in major pollution were also developing cancer treatments and heavily invested in the healthcare industry. So I thought that was quite hypocritical and sort of very beneficial for them, because pollution really pays. I mean, we see companies, for example, there's one company in France who was a huge asbestos maker, and today they're an asbestos cleaner. So they basically take public money now and they clean out asbestos that they help install in homes, in offices, in ships, in different areas. And so they've benefited twice. They've not only benefited from a carcinogen polluting product, but they've also benefited from cleaning that up with public money. They didn't have to put in their own money. So this took me to looking more into these six companies, these six big chemical companies. And then I discovered that these were also the six that were pretty much monopolizing genetically modified crops that are now...
What are the six big chemical companies?
Dow Chemical, DuPont, BASF, Bayer, Monsanto, and AstraZeneca, which AstraZeneca is basically a product of two companies that were Astra. It was a pharmaceutical company, and Zeneca, which was a chemical company, which is also happened from a demerger of ICI, which was a UK chemical company, a huge company. And then an offshoot of their agricultural part became Syngenta, which is today a big player in the genetically modified crop development. So I think, too, is something we never talk about in the chemical industry in these six companies, is a lot of these companies were also involved in the defense industry. And I think that's why, in a certain respect, governments have protected them. And also governments have not criminalized some of the major pollution and poison that these companies have been responsible for. If we take the case of the accident in Italy, Seveso, the small town, where they were making a fungicide at that, I think it was a fungicide, in that company, the person taking care of that factory at the time, it was overheating, so he basically let out a cloud of dioxins and other pollutants into the air illegally.
Yep.
So it was criminal. And yet this guy never, you know, the owner of that company at the time, which is a Swiss company that owned that factory, never went to jail, because his lawyer was a friend of Mitterrand, and Mitterrand basically excused the four people that were taken to trial. So that's completely scandalous as well. But, you know, these people have the right political connections. And if we talk about Dow Chemical, for example, they have great political connections. They've always had them, very strong ones in Michigan, no matter whether it's Republican or Democrat. And that really helps them with their, you know, lobbying and making sure that dioxins are staying out of the public eye, or that we don't talk about it so much and we downplay and trivialize the negative effects of dioxins. And it's also its connection to cancer, because whenever we talk about cancer, these companies become very nervous, because cancer is something you can't really dissociate yourself from, because most people today know somebody who has cancer, who has died from cancer. And the arguments that they give are usually just to plant seeds of doubt, whether there's a connection. Well, we don't know, there's not enough studies. There's an array of public relations and communication tactics that they have that are basically put together by people who are not toxicologists, people who are not doctors, people who have nothing to do with anything in the sciences. These are people just hired to spin a message.
Right.
I know, because I have friends in that industry. So when I see that those are the people hired to talk about something that's so serious and that's health-related in this way, I just think there's a responsibility, too, in people that take a job or work with these companies to know that you're also part of helping to poison people and making that okay.
Yeah, it's very very concern-raising. You have been to Midland, Michigan, where this Dow Chemical Company has a chemical manufacturing facility that caused a tremendous amount of damage to the environment by releasing lots of dioxin pollution. And the way, you know, I don't know nearly as much about this as you do, but part of what I know about it is that it was Dow that was manufacturing the 2,4-5-T and the 2,4-D that were used together, and the 2,4-5-T had the dioxin contaminant, and these were used to manufacture Agent Orange and some of these other, the agent, you know, the there are several agents, not only the Agent Orange, but several other mixtures of these chemicals that were used in the aerial herbicide spraying in Vietnam. And it's, yeah. The way I always thought of it was that, while we were, producing what we used to poison Vietnam, we were poisoning our own state of Michigan. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they're actually, the dioxins were an accident. They were a byproduct of the chemical processing. The defoliant that they used in Vietnam ended up having that contaminant. And unfortunately, even today, they say that 50% of the fruit and vegetables in Vietnam are still dioxin contaminated. There's major health issues there. I mean, there's been documentaries that have focused just on the health problems related to dioxins and Agent Orange in Vietnam. But if we're talking about Midland, Michigan, and we could be talking about a lot of places actually in the States or Canada, because Dow's not the only one responsible for dioxin contamination. I mean, DuPont is a huge source of dioxin contamination as well. If you look even in Freeport, Texas, that's a hugely contaminated city. It has enormous amounts of petrochemical refining going on. Anniston in Alabama, where Monsanto had a huge facilities as well. But what was interesting about Midland is that they found the highest levels ever recorded of dioxin, and it's sort of a crossroads of how one company can really take over one town. Because when we went there, you have the baseball diamond that's called Dow Diamond, the library, there's a garden, there's a high school, everything's named Dow, there's a street. I mean, you can really feel the presence not just in all the signs around town, but most of the people work for Dow or have taken money from them for charity or for community events. And it's incredible to me, but I guess I don't live there, so I can't be too judgmental as well, but to take so little money for such huge damage that this company has made, that people can be silenced just because a company builds a baseball field. I guess the issue, too, is that these places where these companies set up is it's sort of like Sarnia. You need a place where you have access to water, where you can, just like a river, where you can dump all the waste in. And then also people are looking for jobs. So these people have families, and, the companies come to town with a lot of promises and a lot of reassurances. So these people trust these companies. I don't know if I would categorize them as stupid or as anything, but I think that they're trying to make a living for their families. And at one point, you have to make a decision whether what you're doing is right and really beneficial to your family. There's been whistleblowers at these companies. There's been people who have left the companies because they couldn't live with that. And they, sometimes you're in denial. It's like living with an alcoholic. You can be in denial of somebody's problem or that you're actually part of it. And
you're right. There are good aspects of people. Yeah.
And unfortunately, there's it's much more complex than people just wanting to hurt others. I think that at one level, at certain level, the people that aren't there and are most responsible for the company and aren't there really on a daily basis or living in the worstly affected areas, they have a lot to answer to, because those
people.
They certainly do. I've heard things off the record that I frankly don't have. Any respect, really, for the leaders of some of these companies. Maybe some of the people that get hired go in there, and some people have told me they didn't even know anything about the company, anything about its past. So I guess, too, you have to take personal responsibility for, who you're going to work with and what kind of company it is, and whether you think that company has really changed, because actually there's not been a lot of change.
They haven't changed. They haven't changed a bit. They want us to think they are thinking about changing, and they have changed some, but they have not changed. It's what they do. They haven't done anything that's different.
Yeah,
it's
just very difficult to make a lot of, in a business model, it's very difficult to make huge profits with anything that's not going to make, there's going to be some kind of consequence. And whether you're doing something globally, you're going to have to transport things, you're going to have to replace an infrastructure that they've put a lot of money into, and a lot of companies aren't prepared to do that. They may do Band-Aid changes where there's less pollution in certain, manufacturing processes, but on the whole, they can't change everything because it's too costly and they're making too much money to want to do that.
Yeah, we just keep thinking total global environmental revolution.
Okay.
I think it's going to happen, truly. I think it's going to happen, and they're not going to like it. But that's the way it has to be. So you have a message in your movie, in The Idiot Cycle, that government is not protecting the public health. You know, people, most of the, you know, the general public, it is their belief, or at least their expectation, that government is protecting public health, and that's their job. That's their mandate. That's what a huge part of what they're supposedly exist for the purpose of doing. Tell us about, you know, what you have discovered as far as instances in which dioxin and cancer and this failure to protect the public health come into play.
Well, I guess people's expectations are because it's public money that public interests are going to come first, which should be the case. But as a lot of people know, there's a revolving door problem in government, whether it's the States or Canada or in Europe, as we're seeing now with lobbyists and government. When you're a politician or a public servant, I should say, you spend 5 years at your post, and most of the time that doesn't give you really enough time to know a subject matter well enough to make long-term decisions that are going to benefit people who are taking over after you. So you're not even going to get the credit for it. A lot of public servants say, well, sometimes it's better to do nothing than try and take action and then take the responsibility for that action. Sometimes when you do nothing, you actually can stick around longer because nobody can point a finger at you. So right. It's sort of a dilemma in how we're placing public servants, and we're voting for those people too. We're voting for people to have conflict of interest, so that hurts us as well. Then you have to look at people that want to go into public office, especially high public office, whether prime minister or in the States. I'm going to focus on Canada because I'm Canadian, but the two major parties in Canada are the Liberals and Conservatives, and yep. Basically those candidates aren't picked by the public, even though there's a perception that they are. They're picked by a small group of businessmen, you know, the Liberals situated in Toronto and the Conservatives more on the West Coast. And those are the people they find the person that they think the public's going to like, and they pick that person. And we're really at the mercy of profit interests and seriously business interests at the moment.
Certainly.
I think that there were scandals a few years ago in Canada because of the revolving door and the lobbying problem, and they changed some of the laws where they had to wait 5 years before they could work in the private sector in the same industry that they had been in public office for, which was great.
How rough for them. Yeah.
Well, 5 years is better than, you know, 2 months later, because then there's really the policy that you can see that the person was directly affected with it. They're trying to do something like that now in France, and the European Union has never experienced lobbying as it has right now in Brussels, and that didn't really exist in Europe. It started really with the European Union because now everything's centralized in Brussels, so people send their lobbyists to Brussels because now there's really the commissioner of the European Union, for example, for health. If you have a GMO issue, then all your money is going to be funneled there. You have to know, too, that the European commissioners are not democratically elected by the European citizens. They're picked by the European president. So it's not a very democratic system as well. What the Europeans pick or vote for are the parliamentary EU members. So there's another structure that isn't very conducive to making our health a priority or making things a fair playing field.
Right.
We can go into a lot of other little details in government. It goes all the way to local.
Tell me some about the conflicts of interest that you've discovered with regards to these advisory boards and these advisory panels that are just, you know, it sounds like a good idea. You know, you have government selecting these expert boards or panels, mm-hmm. and they are supposedly to advise with government and help make the whole process of moving forward with public health protection a little more broadly based. But how is that being, you know, damaged as far as a way of creating, you know, good public health. How is this being interfered with by conflict of interest?
Well, in the early 70s, the way forward for the public relations of these companies was that industry was, especially after the Vietnam War, was seen as something that was more a deterrent to a good society, and especially the environment and health and social causes. And what happened was that these companies then decided that what they needed to do was fight back for their image. And what they picked were institutions and professions that the public actually trusts. So journalists, academics, intellectuals, universities, associations, things that the public really identifies as being on their side. And little by little, as we're seeing today, there's journalists, there's universities that are pretty much very tied into a private-public partnership.
Very much.
Right.
Very,
and
very
so then
different.
We get now a public who trusts these people, but these people aren't actually there to do a balanced reporting. They're really there to transmit the information that the industry wants you to have.
Well, say like the advisory board, say what IARC has and what
right.
WHO has.
So to keep going with that train of thought, basically they have the World Health Organization and the United Nations is another entity that people see as something public-based and something, because it does receive public money, is something that is on the public side and is there for the good of everybody, especially the World Health Organization. I mean, there are very good people that work there, and they do some very good work. And the problem is that these conflict of interests are now creeping in. The working group that puts together the monographs for carcinogens, it's basically the International Research Agency for Cancer that's based in Lyon, France. They put out monographs that are worldwide respected,
right,
and, you know, used by governments to decide whether something's going to be carcinogen and how to structure policy around that. Unfortunately, the working group, for example, that is putting together the 2010 to 2014 monographs had on its advisory board people who had worked for Bayer Crop Science, for example, somebody else who worked. There's a couple people there had worked for industry. I mean, maybe they're trying to find experts in those areas, but it's very disheartening and very worrying that something that's supposed to be completely public, we can't even find now experts who are completely hired by the public, whether it's a public university or a government institution, to make sure that they have no conflict of interest and that they can remain independent and criticize something or analyze it without any afterthought of what's this going to do to my consulting fee or what's this going to do to my ability to get another job with an industry where they're paying you from anywhere from $500 to, I don't know, $2,000 a week to give you a consulting fee. I mean, the consulting fees are huge. So the incentive to protect that over the public that they don't have really any contact with is, I don't know, it's getting into a very gray area. I mean, maybe some people have such amazing morals that they can make the difference. But, you know, it's in terms of health, I don't think that's a risk I want to take.
There's no point.
It's just too important.
We have been trying to work with the WHO on this standard. It's the provisional tolerable monthly intake for dioxins.
Mm-hmm.
And that number is put in place, established by the JECFA, the Joint Expert FAO-WHO Committee on Food Additives, and this was put in place in 2001 based on a monograph that JECFA produced. And the problem is that this provisional tolerable monthly intake, and they say tolerable, and in other words means that it's an acceptable level of intake, is right about what the average consumer of animal fat, depending on, you know, where they get their animal fat, and a few variables. But still, it's very close. It's actually a little above the average amount of consumption. And see, that makes people feel comfortable. It makes so that there are no waves that the industrial, you know, super liners have to deal with. And it just keeps things, the status quo, the same old, and just business and money, and it's just going round and round. Problem is, it is not based on science. There is no basis whatsoever for concluding that this amount of intake is tolerable. And when you look at the membership of the JECFA, there are so many U.S. people on there. There's a Canadian on there, this Dr. Mark Feely, who works for Health Canada, who is nothing more than a scoundrel. I've talked to him. He is devious. He is untruthful. He will not communicate beyond the superficial. These people are not good people. They are, you know, they don't make any effort to even convince one that they are good people. Very arrogant, very, you know, kind of comfortable with what they are doing because they feel that with all this power, all this money, all these huge corporations that back them up, they will just do as they please. It's almost just like Marie Antoinette, let them get cancer, you know, spin rather than let them eat cake. So we're finding exactly as you say that there is this horrible conflict of interest on these boards that really rule. They have a huge amount to do with the with what should be the safety of the food supply, and they've turned it into this creation of illusions about the safety, which means we're not getting protected, and people around the world are eating food with dioxin contamination that imposes a significant and more than acceptable amount of cancer risk. And this is not talking about the accidents where there's more dioxin in particular food supplies. This is about the overall, you know, all the animal fat of the whole world at levels that impose too much cancer. And that's why we have this cancer epidemic, you know, around the world. Cancer is the number one killer now in the world, number two in the U.S., and it's going to number one. So, you know, we are so much on the same page with you and your movie, The Idiot Cycle, when it comes to these boards, these advisory boards and their expertise and their conflicts of interest and their damage they're causing to the public health.
Yeah, and sometimes it's I guess it's more that there's a loss of perspective too, and some of these people are very, very intelligent, especially in the university world. If we look at Koch Industries, for example, they're the largest privately owned company in the United States and based in Kansas. And they're a huge petrochemical refining company. They're incredibly one of the worst polluters in America. And yet they've given much, much money to John Hopkins Hospital, MIT Cancer Research, Sloan Kettering. I mean,
yep.
And I'm talking millions, like 20
yep.
to 25 millions.
Yep.
So here's a huge conflict of interest, too. I mean, if you're accept, if you're, I mean, I can talk about, I was raised in Vancouver in the BC Cancer Fund, where they do matching gift fund, and
yep.
there's matching gift fund, there's, you know, Dow Chemical, there's DuPont, there's Monsanto, there's all those companies there. So at one point, these associations also have to take a look at what they're doing and what kind of money they're accepting. Is it acceptable to fight cancer and be
yep.
a nonprofit and also take money from companies that are causing the, I mean, you're not helping to
they're not
reduce
take a look
the
at it.
Problem.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. You seem to be more, you know, kind of, you see better in these things than what we see in them, truly. I have to say, from my long experience with the American Cancer Society, that the other acronym, the ACS, the American Chemical Society, that it is no, you know, no one's making a mistake if they ever were to confuse those two entities because they are the same thing. We have found so many instances in which the ACS, this cancer.org, and this cancer.gov, which is the National Cancer Institute,
mm-hmm.
that they are so much just another face of the corporate, the overlord, and these kind of corporate overlord, just this corporate dominance of our whole world and our societies and our nations, that they're part of it, and they don't need to look at it because they know it, and they're not going to look at it because they know it, and they have no interest in moving away from it because they like it like that. You know, this is what we're finding over and over again. These powerful parts of our society like having this power. They enjoy the prestige, the money, the dominance, all these things. And it is not the case that just a little of this has snuck in, you know, and just a little bit of the, you know, the whole overarching group, say, like with American Cancer Society. American Cancer Society, I've talked to their epidemiologist, Dr. Michael Toon. I've talked with people that are involved with our New York State Cancer Control Program. And ACS runs the New York State Comprehensive Cancer Control Program. They determine what is in the cancer control plan. They control this so fully. And it didn't just happen. You said about Memorial Sloan Kettering. They have an awful record for how they use science to come up with these treatments. And the treatments are not the solution. It is prevention that's the solution. And nobody, we cannot find any partners. We've tried to get the ACS just to let us do information tables at their events, this Relay for Life, these survivor dinners, and these various other public events that the American Cancer Society conducts. They refuse year after year to let us even have an information table on pollution, the names of the chemicals, where they're at in the environment, and how to reduce your exposure to them.
Well, I'm pretty sure there's a few reasons for that, because one, most of the medical community can't do anything about it. Once you dioxins are in you, they're going to be in you. They have a half-life of up to 15 years. So
yeah, but you got to stop eating this stuff. That's the key to it.
Yeah, I know, but there's you know, when you talk to a doctor, they're there to treat you. So most doctors will say, well, I don't know, you know, what we pollutants they're passed on to your fetus as well if you're a woman and your children. So
horrible.
It's true. I'm much more for prevention because it is a preventable disease, and there's a lot of things that we can be doing that the cancer establishment, of course, is not taking seriously enough, and there's a reason for that because they say
reasons for it. Yeah, they don't want to take it seriously because of the conflict of interest.
Yeah, and that's really eroding information and facts and science and information, certainly for the public. I think that it's also eroding our health.
Oh, horrible.
So I know it's and at the end of the day too, we are part of that cycle because if you have a car and you're using gasoline, that gasoline's been refined. It's refined every time you put, you know, these are things that we talk a lot about smoking, especially the cancer establishment, but there's a lot of things that we waste or that we could do differently. We can still live comfortably because there's actually been a study done, and they said that the country that uses less amount of energy, for example, but that lives very comfortably is Portugal. And you know, why do most other countries, especially Western countries like Canada and the States, are huge, huge wasters of a lot of things? I mean, 40% of the food produced in the States is wasted. And that's not just a waste of food, but it's a waste of energy. It's a waste of a lot of things along the way.
Exactly.
But those are things that are not very sexy and they're not very interesting. And a lot of politicians, it's like too much work to get into to deal with
those
types
of problems. Well, you made a movie about it. You made a movie about it, so you didn't need sex, you didn't need violence, right?
No, but
yeah,
I mean,
that's
like,
the cool thing, you know.
You know, the things with, like, waste or things like that, very simple things that could, nobody applauds that kind of thing. What people applaud is they want a hero. They want somebody who can donate millions, who can put on a very fancy dinner where you can, you know, sit next to a celebrity. And unfortunately, the people that are doing the real work and getting their hands dirty, those are the people that we should be thankful for because those are the people who are, you know, making us food that's healthy for us or not flying in a jet to get to some $1,000 seat. I mean, there's so many things I could talk about, like AstraZeneca. They're the ones that control and they decide what information is in Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Most people don't even know that Breast Cancer Awareness Month belongs to AstraZeneca. So why would AstraZeneca ever talk about pesticides or insecticides or anything else that Zeneca used to make or things that could cause problems or are causing problems? Because they were part of the problem. So
that's right.
And the thing is, too, I had to discover this, unfortunately, when my mother was sick. And before that, I wasn't really taking a serious interest in what carcinogens were and how things were affecting my health. So unfortunately, sometimes you have to have like a disaster happen in your own family for people to wake up, which is unfortunate. But I wasn't receiving any of this information from anyone, anywhere. At school, we talked about ozone layer depletion and everything like that. But I think that sometimes when things touch on people personally, it becomes a little bit controversial. So people tend to want to remove themselves from that conversation, whether it's education, because then teachers will get the finger pointed at them, and then they think that they're trying to make children into activists, Yep. But I think to make people into concerned citizens and make people into thinkers is incredibly important, or else we're going to be a society where everyone just kind of follows without, you know, like we're a bunch of zombies. So I think that's why most people remove them. And then the good thing that the companies can do as well is marginalize certain people. So if you're somebody that can be caricatured or somebody that seems that they're often an extreme or saying things that displease the public, like, you know, you should really try and use your bike instead of taking your car, people don't want to hear that because people don't want to make that change. So it becomes very easy for the company to say, oh, look at this person. They want everyone to be a hippie, or they want... But that's really...
An old hippie.
But that's the thing, you know, I didn't...
Yep, that's right.
There's a lot of things that we don't actually need, and my life is just as fine and comfortable now as it was before. So I think that if you don't try, you won't know, and I can't speak for everyone, but I think that, you know, I don't want to be... I want to be responsible for my own actions and for my company's actions and for what the films I make. So I really need to just focus on myself. I don't want to be a preacher. I have people that come up to me and ask me for information, especially friends and family, and I'm very happy to have debates with them because sometimes I think that they want to be reassured that what they're doing is not bad, but I can't do that because there's some information that they don't have that they should be aware of. And then after, they have to know that also their actions do have consequences for people around them. It's just like secondhand smoke. You don't think that just because you want to destroy your health, that's not going to affect people around you.
Right.
So... I know, I mean, no one's perfect, but there's so many opportunities each day to do something differently. And
it's like we have to change. We truly have to change everything to even be living to the extent of, say, using science to be healthy, let alone to have a good vibe and be together with the good spirits and all these other parts of life that could be so much better than, you know, just being part of the industrial machinery.
Yeah.
Wow, we got a long ways away from the good stuff.
Yeah, but I guess the thing, too, is what I liked about the early environmental movement, because my father was friends with a group of people who was also Bob Hunter, one of the founders of Greenpeace.
Okay.
And I think what was interesting at the beginning is people really, not that there's something pure about it, but something, they really did it just for the fact that they were really, really worried about the future of their children. And then now I see, like, the World Wildlife Fund, they do a lot of partnerships with a lot of big companies, like making pans and all this merchandising. And I'm thinking, what along the way, I don't know, they're trying to be, I guess, a multinational nonprofit organization. And something that's, the message for me just kind of loses its power along the way somewhere.
Exactly.
And I don't want to be name-calling people, too, in the chemical industry. I just, because I think that what they do and how they marginalize environmentalists and activists and people that are really concerned and have intelligent things to say and really have concerns that we should be addressing. I don't really like the way that they treat those people. I don't want to call names because that's too easy, but I have a very, very strong one in my film, and I think that at the end of the day is what we should be debating, that argument. Sometimes the public should be getting angry in the way that they express themselves, and I'm not talking about violently, but I mean whether doing a protest or being very visible, and I think that's very important. I remember being at a dinner with a head of state, and he said that his biggest fear was actually when he saw a protest, mass protest. Like, that's the only thing that made him think twice about whatever it was that they were protesting. And I think that's probably human nature. I think that if people see people banding together, not so much for the companies, but the people that that affects is really the public servants, because they depend on those people in the street or those people protesting and writing letters to be where they are. So, you know, these people aren't black and white on their thinking. They have families too, and at one point they're going to feel that socially it's not responsible for them to be doing what they are.
Hopefully there'll be many more whistleblowers. We
need
them very much here in the U.S.,
I think that what we're doing is the film is going to be out on TV in 2011.
Okay.
So what we've done in the meantime is we're going to make the film available to rent on the film's website, theidiotcycle.com. And we've done that because we didn't want to make DVDs. We didn't want to produce plastic. And I think it's also ridiculous when documentary filmmakers make films about important subjects that they seem to be very passionate about and then don't follow through on how they put that project out there, because at the end of the day it is a product, and it's something I'm selling. Because it's so personal to me, and I've lost friends before the age of 30 to cancer as well, not just my mom. But, you know, I'm in Vancouver right now at a memorial because a very close friend of our family has passed away from ovarian cancer. And so the reality hits me every day. I mean, I meet people at the screenings who have cancers. I was in the Netherlands a couple months ago, and this young 22-year-old, he had had cancer of the nose. And I don't know if that has something to do with Chernobyl, but that's another thing we don't talk about very much in Europe, especially France, because it's a big nuclear country. You know, I'm reminded of cancer every day with this film, and sometimes it's a little too much for one person, but I'm doing it really for the people that I miss because they're no longer here. And I think that it's important that whoever has somebody they've lost to cancer, to try and see the film. And, you know, we're also setting up the film where you can rent it for friends and family as well. So you just have to put in their email address and off you go. I think that's the most important, is to share the film with people that you know have been touched by cancer, and to know exactly why you're not getting all the information that you should be. And information is really important because that's how you can protect yourself. And, you know, I want to make it, we say the internet is very democratic, but the internet is also a way of dissipating. I mean, it's another tool that these companies can use where they make up actual citizens that pretend to be people, and they get on message boards and write nasty things about people. And, you know, the Bivins Group is one of these companies that they've hired where they do viral marketing in that way. And so they have all these underhanded ways, anonymous ways to undermine a movie or somebody who's criticizing them. So I think it's also good to be aware of that. If you really hate the film, then at least you can discuss it with your friends. I prefer when people don't leave messages anonymously, and I like when people come to the screenings, and that way we can all talk. And Yeah, and I think it's so silly to leave messages. I don't know, because I don't know who those people are. They could be anybody. And so also we're trying to allow people to host screenings of the film, which it's exploding right now in Europe. We're getting so many requests, to go all over in Europe. We don't have as very many requests for the States. And
We request you to come here.
No, we've had a very hard time, and especially
Cancer Action New York begs you guys to come to the St. Lawrence River Valley and do a screening here, because we have so much cancer here and so much pollution here. One of the strongest members of Cancer Action New York right now is this Michelle Reed. She was diagnosed with colorectal cancer in 2005, and now she has nodules on her thyroid. She had 2 or 3 lesions removed from her face. She is not recovered from this, and yet she's gone through the chemo, the radiation, and now they're talking about maybe removing her thyroid. She's just struggling and struggling. She was at the Winter Cancer Treatment Center in the city of Ogdensburg in the St. Lawrence River yesterday, and she started talking about her life. And the people that were sitting there started talking to her about their life. And the Cancer Treatment Center, you know, kind of administrator, this Jerry Shepard, he wanted to get Michelle separated from those people, but they talked. She ignored him. These people that had the cancer talked about how they are concerned about the pollution that is causing this here in our, you know, part of New York State. And, wow, if this is starting to come together, and we would just, you know, love to have a movie like yours to, you know, bring this fuller into flower, so to speak.
Yeah, well, if just email me and we can organize something. There's we're getting associations that are organizing little screenings in villages, I mean, in the middle of France, and it's fantastic, because I think that they really put up obstacles for us to release the film in North America. We didn't get the insurance. They didn't give us an official reason.
What do you have the insurance for?
Well, we need insurance to release films. Basically, you don't need it in Europe. You may in a couple of years, but you don't need it in Europe, but you do need it in North America. So that's really put roadblocks.
Can stop you from using
Well, what happened is the companies that insure films in Canada for this type of insurance also insure petrochemical companies and biotech companies.
Yeah,
we didn't get an official letter stating exactly what in the film they disapproved of or was a problem. They just said subject matter. And
the subject matter of who poisoned all of us.
that was the only reason they gave us. And then they just said, no, we can't insure this film, so we can't do this.
Is that the end of it? If they don't insure it, what happens?
Then we can put the film out. Then that means that a TV channel really believes in the film, and they're going to put it out, and they're going to insure it for us.
Oh, I see.
But it's basically, we've done a few screenings in Canada, and we haven't done any screenings in the States yet.
Well,
because of
cool.
that, we've really just focused on Europe, because they've really been, as well, the Europeans have been much more open-minded, and I'm not saying that North Americans are closed-minded.
Well, you're right. They are. They're horribly closed-minded. I guess I'm 54 years old, and I've suffered like hell because they're closed-mindedness my whole life. Believe me, it's real.
Yeah,
there's plenty of closed-mindedness.
I think maybe it seems very shocking to them because the lack of information that's available is so
exactly.
huge.
They're just used to being brainwashed.
Well,
people in the U.S. have gotten used to being led around by the nose by these chemical companies. It's outrageous is what it is, and we're going to change that, and you're helping us change it, and we honor you for doing what you do, and hopefully we will do some of these things together so it'll get better and better and better. We do want a revolution in the United States. The United States needs to throw off these corporate overlords. It's not good. I don't want to get cancer. I don't like having our relatives get cancer. Speaking of that, how did your mother's cancer turn out?
She had a mastectomy, and she was in treatment for a year and a half. And after that, there was huge life changes for us. We did a lot of things differently, and she's today in remission. She's the only person I actually know that is in remission. We've lost all of our other friends, and it's been rough. I know people say that cancer treatments are getting better. I haven't seen that personally, but
no,
maybe the figures are different.
About 3%.
I think, too, that the treatments, the cost, are ridiculously high. I mean, some
ridiculous.
Cancer treatments are $50,000 a year, and these chemical companies and these pharmaceutical companies said, well, we have to do the research, we have to do these clinical trials, we need money to develop these treatments, but most of them are derived from treatments that already existed, and they're not prolonging people's lives that much. So the $50,000 that we're paying right now on one person's treatment for a year, wouldn't that be better used that we put together a study that cost $2.5 million, have it paid by the public, and have some sort of prevention, a database where anybody who wants to license a chemical or genetically modified food or crop has to do a long-term study on their product, and it's the government that funds it, so we have independent scientists that are doing it. We pay for it, and then there's not the millions and millions that we have to spend after cleaning up the contamination or the people that get sick. I mean, the amount of money that we're wasting is
incredible.
Huge. And the small amount of money that would actually take to set something up like that and test those things before they came on the market would probably be a good idea, and it saved a lot of people.
Phenomenal economics for the people, but see, not economics for the companies. And the companies don't care about economics for the people.
That's why what I tried to do, and I don't know what's going to happen with this film. I hope more and more people want to see it, but I'm... You know, this is, for me, is sort of like a love letter as well, this film, because it's, I think I've had a blessed life and I've been very lucky. And if this is the last film I make because I have problems later financing another film or whatever, I'm okay with that because I think it was really important to make. And I think most of us aren't aware of the hypocrisy we're living in our own lives and just to be responsible for our own actions and,
Thank you so much, Emmanuel Garcia, for the Idiot Cycle and for your, this great interview you've given us today.
Well, we didn't talk much about dioxins, but there's a lot of information on the website, theidiotcycle.com.
Our website is canceractionny.org.
Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers and other brave men. And they'll take the money and spread it.
This show and all previous shows are available
from unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.